Thank you all so much. It's really an honor to be here and a real privilege to come here and talk with you. And thank you very much to Amy for arranging this, and also to the Vice Chancellor Moransky for her kind introduction. And thanks to all of you for being here. And thanks for asking questions, you know, about what does it mean to be engaged, and what does it mean to be a part of society? What does it mean to try to change society at a time when we desperately need change? And there's nobody who knows that better, I think, than your generation, than millennials, on whom really all the burdens of society are falling in such a big way right now. And by way of introduction, I want to just let you know that I'm by training a medical doctor, and I used to practice clinical medicine, taking care actually of college-age students in a college clinic, and I actually did that for a couple decades. But then I moved from clinical medicine to what I would call political medicine, because it's the mother of all illnesses, that is politics and our political system. It's the mother of all illnesses, and we got to fix that one if we want to fix the other things that are literally killing us, whether you're talking about our economy, the cost of education, student debt, our healthcare system, the expanding wars, the export of our jobs, you name it. We're facing just really serious battles all around, and I think nobody is feeling that more right now than your generation. And you are asking exactly the questions that should be asked right now, you know, about how do we fix this and what is it that really needs to change. And I guess what I really learned being a doctor in the clinic is that we're kind of put in these boxes. You know, you have healthcare over here, you have education over here, you have the environment here, you've got war over there, and we're sort of told that, you know, just stick in your little box and work very hard inside that box. But what we're discovering is that the box is collapsing in on us all over the place. And you know, there's kind of a revolt going on now, and certainly we see that in the election. So I felt like inside the healthcare clinic, I was looking at these whole new epidemics of asthma. We didn't used to have it, believe it or not. You know, when my generation grew up, we didn't have asthma. Now, you know, it's like everybody has asthma, and learning disabilities, and cancer, and obesity, and diabetes. This is just, you know, this is like taken for granted, like this is an act of nature, but it didn't used to be. So anyhow, inside the clinic, I just began to feel like it wasn't okay to just give people pills and push them back out to the things that are making us sick to start with. Everything from air pollution to poverty and homelessness and the lack of jobs and a really sick food system that provide subsidies to this really lousy food that makes us sick and makes healthy food really expensive and creates food deserts, you know, for so many people now who don't have access to good and nutritious food. So I felt like, you know, in the health clinic, I was part of trying to drag people out of the water who were drowning. But really, if you were ever going to get ahead of this, you had to go upstream and find out who's throwing us in. Who's throwing us into the water to start with? You know, and so I started moving upstream, started working with communities to try to clean up coal plants, to shut down incinerators and instead bring on recycling programs. Because what happens when you do that? Well, then suddenly you're not polluting the air, and incinerators produce all this toxic ash as well. So then you're not polluting the land, which eventually leaks into the water. Plus, you're putting materials back into use instead of wasting them. and burning them and trashing them, you actually put them back to use and you can create new products out of them. And it turns out you create way more jobs when you have a recycling industry than when you have an incineration industry or a landfill industry. And the same is true for clean renewable energy, that if we switch over to solar and wind and energy conservation and weatherizing our homes and all that stuff, you create just a bonanza of jobs for people, way more jobs. In fact, for every dollar that you would put into fossil fuel energy, you create, or put it this way, for every one job, the money that it would take to create one job in the fossil fuel industry, you can instead create three jobs in renewable energy. Well, why can you do that? It turns out that in fossil fuel energy, there are huge profits that are being made by large corporations. So that's where the money is going. But when you have distributed renewables at the community level so that homeowners and renters and schools and businesses and town halls and things like that, they're all the owners of the energy. So you're not having this huge corporation that's making out like a bandit. And instead, you can employ more people at good wages and give them jobs. So it's not only good for our economy, it's really good for our health too, because turns out, you know, what's good for the environment is good for us. So it all kind of comes together. And instead of allowing ourselves to be divided up into one group over here that's, you know, fighting to keep our public schools open, you know, and another group over here that's trying to stop the fracking from coming and polluting our air and our water, you know, instead we all get together and we demand a world and an America that works for all of us. And it's like that's what the status quo really doesn't want, is when we get together and demand the world that we actually deserve. And let me say right up front a word about debt, because I think student debt is a huge problem for all kinds of reasons. And let me just say up front, we found a way to bail out the bankers, right? The bankers who crashed the economy because of their waste, fraud, and abuse that they should have gone to jail for, but they haven't been prosecuted yet because our government, both political parties, have let them all off the hook and looked the other way. So we bailed out the crooks to the tune of $16 trillion. Don't you think it's about time we bailed out the students who are the victims of that waste, fraud, and abuse? To me, it's absolutely unconscionable that we should be charging people for public higher education, and I'll tell you why. For one thing, it pays for itself, so it's really a scam to say that we can't afford it, because when people are trained and can actually get good jobs, it turns out that what you produce puts 7 times as much back into the economy for every $1 that taxpayers spend on public higher education. And we know that from the GI Bill after the Second World War, when we put returning soldiers to school, to college for free. And for every $1 that we invested, we got back $7 in improved benefits. So it pays for itself. And in fact, we can't afford not to do it. We can't afford not to have a society which is broadly educated. And here's the other thing. In my age, when we were growing up, you know, you needed a high school degree for economic security. And you could get a good job in a factory and earn a good wage, and you could actually support a family on one factory worker's wage way back then. So we provided a high school degree as a right. And it's a way to launch the younger generation into a secure future. That's what we did in the 20th century. But in the 21st century, a high school degree doesn't do it. You need to have a college degree. So by right, then, we should be providing what's necessary for a secure future to launch the younger generation into. So that's why, you know, when you go out there and you tell people that you deserve a free public higher education, you should not be guilt-tripped about that, not one bit. And this is what adults owe their young people, in my view, is a secure start in life. And the fact that these predatory loans have been inflicted on your generation, in my view, is absolutely shameful. It's a national disgrace. We need to put an end to it by making public higher education free and by bailing out student debt entirely. It will be the best stimulus package for our economy. And it will cost way less than what we spent to bail out the bankers. Anybody know how much we spent to bail out the bankers and Wall Street? It's a big number. Well, it's $6 trillion and counting. It's now said to be, and this is according to the General Accounting Office, so it's not like some radical fringe economic group that estimated this. It's actually $16 trillion in bailouts and basically free loans, essentially cheap and free money that have been given to the banks that they in turn loan out at high predatory rates and make a killing off of it. So if we spent $16 trillion on the crooks who crashed the economy through their reckless waste and abuse, we can spend $1.3 trillion canceling student debt. And that's what it would take, is $1.3 trillion. And just so that you don't feel like this is an academic issue or it's just pie in the sky, what you should know is that the number of people who are held hostage right now by student debt is enough to win the upcoming presidential election. There are 43 million young people who are trapped in college debt, and 43 million is a plurality of the vote. It's a winning number of the vote in a three-way race, and this is going to be at least a four-way race coming up: Democrat, Republican, Green, Libertarian, and potentially others who might, you know, jump in as independents, possibly Donald Trump, if he doesn't get the Republican nomination, and Michael Bloomberg as well. So it's at least a four-way race. So what you need to know is that student debt can decide this race. And young people who are being enslaved, in my view, in an economy that doesn't allow you the quality jobs to pay back debt, if that demographic comes out to vote, you can take over the election. So you can keep that a secret, or you can let your friends know. And I'll just say there's only one campaign that will cancel student debt, and I'm not going to tell you who it is. You're going to have to figure that out. But, you know, making college education free, there are several candidates that support that now. But I must say, in the last election, I was the only one. I was the only candidate in 2012 that was calling for free public higher education. So this is what public pressure can do. And public pressure can actually win this in 2016 if you decide to do that. And the other thing you should know is that this doesn't have to go through Congress, because the Federal Reserve has the power to do this if they declare it an emergency, which it should be declared. To have an entire generation held hostage in perpetual debt, would you say that's an emergency? Yes. I would agree with you. And I think most people in debt would agree that it's an emergency. So the president appoints the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve can do a thing called quantitative easing. Is that a familiar name? It's kind of smoke and mirrors. It's magic with numbers. But basically what it means is they canceled the debt using a lot of quantitative easing and a few other things. But doing quantitative easing, it means essentially that the federal government absorbs that debt, and we're all better for it. So that is really critical, I think, to the health of society, to the health of our economy, because it's always been the younger generation that creates change. It's always been the young, in the civil rights movement, you know, in Tahrir Square, who was it that was calling for democracy? You know, it's always been young people. In the labor movement, it's been young people. In the civil rights movement. And right now, young people are kind of busy working two or three or four jobs, you know, if you're lucky enough to get them. And it basically deprives society of the leadership we need from young people to help envision the future, to help reimagine the economy in the world that we need. It needs the fresh vision of a younger generation. And so all of society benefits from liberating young people. It's going to be very hard for us to get out of the mess that we're in without the vision and the commitment of young people. And in my view, that's another reason why we have to cancel student debt. Let me just say a couple other things about why we need really transformative change now. So student debt is one piece of it. The other one, obviously, you know, the economy is in a crisis. The jobs have come back to some extent, but these are mostly temporary and part-time jobs, which are at an all-time high. And average wages for workers now are just barely above the poverty level. So this is not okay. Household wealth has been slashed to about 40% of what it was. There are enormous racial disparities that are imposed on that. The average African American family used to have 10 cents on the dollar that a Caucasian family had, because of inequities in education, in housing, you name it. It's been impossible for African American families to be able to really accumulate security and wealth. And that ratio used to be 10 cents on the dollar. But with the Wall Street crash, who was hit hardest? It was particularly communities of color, homeowners who had been targeted by especially predatory debt. And that 10 cents dropped to 5 cents on the dollar. And this is the kind of incredible, mind-boggling racial disparities imposed on an economy that's already incredibly unequal. You may have heard this statistic, that worldwide now there are 62 billionaires who have as much money as half of the world's population, 3.5 billion people. So is that fair for 62 people to have what 3.5 billion people have to share? No way. You know, there's just not enough to go around. We need not only a minimum wage. You know, I think there's an argument here for a maximum wage. People should not be allowed to hoard scarce resources that everybody needs in order to survive. So the point there being that this is not an economy that's going to sustain itself for very long. You may not be aware, because this statistic doesn't get out very much, but 71% of the world's population lives in deep poverty now. They try not to let that out. But it's the vast, vast majority that is just struggling to survive, you know, and it's a very small portion of the world that's not. And that's mostly North America and Western Europe that's not in poverty right now. So this is an extremely unstable situation and feeds into the more global problems in international security that we'll come to in a moment. So at any rate, the economy is in crisis. Let me also mention that the ecology is in crisis. And, you know, the theme of tonight's talk is sort of health, personal health, and politics, and what do they have to do with each other? Well, the point is that personal health is no longer just about whether you happen to have diabetes or whether you have high blood pressure. It's whether or not you have access to a healthcare system at all. And it's also like whether we're going to have a food system that can even feed us. You may have heard last week, did anybody hear this news from the UN that the, what are called the pollinators, are at serious risk for disappearing right now? So the pollinators are like bees. You may have heard about the crisis with bees. Is that familiar to anybody? You've heard about the bees. Yeah, well, it turns out it's also the butterflies, other species that pollinate. If you don't have pollination going on, you know what? Doesn't matter how much fertilizer you use, how many seeds you plant, you can't produce any crops. You know, food production grinds to a halt. And this is one of the things that we're facing now in as a consequence, really, of a predatory economy. And I didn't mention that, but I should have said that. The problem with the economy is not just that it's so unequal, but that it's been run for profit. It's been run for profit for the few in a system that puts profits over people. Well, that same system has been putting profits over the planet. And so that's why we're facing an ecology that is crashing. Pollinators that are at risk of dying out. We're in what's called now the sixth great extinction. Does that ring a bell to anybody? It means a lot of creatures are dying out. Now it's climate change. It's also reckless development that has basically eliminated habitat that animals need. And animals aren't just about tree hugging, you know. Biodiversity is not just about hugging the trees. It's about maintaining a web of life that we depend on because we live in that web of life. We're dependent on it for our food, for our water cycle, for stabilizing the climate. You know, you get rid of the trees and then suddenly you can't keep the carbon dioxide in balance because the trees are, they help bring down that carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and all that. So you start messing with the tree of life, you know, and that tree is going to collapse right out from under you. And that's where we are right now at the beginning of this state of extinction. And one other thing about the ecology crisis, which affects not only our health, but whether or not we're going to get out of here alive. These are no longer like consequences that are centuries away. They may not even be decades away. You know, this could be years away even. In the same way that suddenly Katrina happened, you know, this superstorm and a set of barriers that collapsed on us, you know, we're in the perfect storm here, and that perfect storm can happen on many fronts. There's also the concern now that the marine food chain could collapse right out from under us, which means no more food from basically from the oceans, and a lot of people depend on, you know, some food from the oceans, like fish and stuff like that, and shells, mussels, and scallops, and food like that. It turns out that the climate change makes the oceans more acid, and the acid in the ocean is eroding the little tiny skeletons that the microscopic creatures have. And those microscopic creatures are at the base of the whole marine food chain. And recent studies have shown that lots of these microscopic creatures don't have the shells that they need in order to survive, and that they are at risk for perishing. And we are plowing ahead, you know, on fossil fuel production, in spite of all the lip service that you hear to this issue from, particularly from the White House. You know, they're giving it lip service. Congress isn't even giving it lip service. You know, Congress is totally obstructive. The White House is, what should we say, talks out of both sides of its mouth. So they talk about, what do they call it, all of the above, which means, yeah, produce renewable energy, but produce much more fossil fuels, which is what they've done. And even when they were in Paris, giving lip service to this voluntary agreement to reduce fossil fuels, what were they actually doing? They were massively increasing fossil fuel production. There used to be a ban on exporting oil from the U.S. They removed that ban, which basically creates a massive stimulus for producing lots more fossil fuels here. So, you know, they're sort of speaking with forked tongue, which is why, in my view, you know, we have an emergency. We are all in the target hairs right now, and it's really important for us to stand up, not for what we think we can get, what's politically feasible. We need to change the politics that's killing us, that's putting us in the target hairs. And that's why, to my mind, citizen action is really all about standing up for what we deserve, for a future that allows us to survive, for one thing, and not go down with the ship here, but also that allows us to thrive. And there are policies that can make this all happen. I'm going to just run through a few quickly, because I'm sure our time is, what's our time check here now? Yeah, okay, great. So let me just say quickly, let me give you an example of how fixable this is. And that's what I found like most frustrating of all, being a doctor in the clinic. That's why I moved from clinical medicine to political medicine, because it's a fight. You can have all the good solutions in the world, but you have to fight for it. And you have to build that coalition to fight. And I just want to say, we have that coalition right now. Just from young people throwing off debt, that is a winning coalition right there. And that That can be the springboard for transformational change. And just to address the two big problems here, we already talked about how to fix debt, how to make higher education free. It pays for itself. But here's how you deal with the climate crisis, the ecological crisis, and the jobs crisis all at once. So you've all heard about the Great Depression, right, back in the 1930s. And you've heard about the New Deal that helped get us out of the Great Depression. They basically said, hey, we need jobs. People need jobs. They need good jobs to get us out of this depression and jumpstart the economy. Well, that's what we need to do right now. We need to declare that emergency in our economy and an emergency in the climate and create not just a new deal, but a green new deal that actually greens the economy at the same time we put everybody back to work. So we're talking about not 2 million or 5 or 10 million jobs. We're talking about 20 million living wage jobs that basically rebuild our communities, rebuild our society, and transform us to the green future. So it means green energy. It means a healthy, sustainable, green food system, so we can have that healthy food in every community. And it means public transportation, and also providing other infrastructure we need, where we need to rebuild schools, bridges, et cetera, and restoring ecosystems. So it's like what they did in the Great Depression, but it's going to go on for a longer time, because we got to transform the whole economy. And bear in mind, we can do this. When Pearl Harbor was bombed at the start of the Second World War for the U.S., you know how long it took us to move into a wartime economy? Because we were at zero wartime economy when we got bombed. We were completely unprepared. It took us 6 months. That's all it took, was 6 months to go from 0% of GDP to 25% of GDP to meet that crisis. Well, now we have a crisis that's even bigger than Pearl Harbor, because we're not just going to lose one harbor here. We're losing all harbors, because we're looking at the breakup of the ice sheets and massive increase in sea level. They're talking now not 5 feet, not 10 feet, but potentially 20 or 30 feet in the next, potentially the next five or so decades. It used to be thought, no, it's millennia away. Now they're realizing it's not millennia away. Greenland is beginning to break up. We need dramatic transformation. If we dramatically transform, we can stop this. But we can't keep putting this off year after year. So this is why we're calling for a Green New Deal to reach 100% renewable energy by 2030. That means everybody's got a job here. Yes. And as part of that, we're calling for an immediate ban on all new fossil fuel infrastructure and exploration. That means no fracking, no new offshore oil, no new public lands exploration. We need to as an emergency, start creating the solar and the wind and the geothermal and the conservation. That's what we should be putting our dollars into right now. No more on fossil fuels. And what this does is not only jumpstart the economy, because then suddenly everybody's got a job, it also turns the tide on climate change in the time frame that we need, and it makes wars for oil obsolete. When we've got all the energy we need right here at home, clean, healthy energy, we can no longer justify these wars for oil, which have been such a disaster, has cost us $6 trillion over the last 15 years that we've had this war for oil, also called a war on terror. But unfortunately, the two go together. The wars for oil are the war on terror. And we've spent $75,000 per household, is how that averages out, that we've spent, and we've killed tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers who've been killed or maimed, and over 1 million people in Iraq alone have been killed, and that's not winning us the hearts and minds of the Middle East. In fact, these wars on terror have only created more terror, so it's nuts to keep doing the same thing. We're calling for a peace offensive. We need a weapons embargo to the Middle East. The U.S. has been the main supplier of weapons to all sides, so we can basically stop these wars in their tracks. We can stop ISIS in its tracks.
tracks by denying ISIS the weapons that it's getting through the Saudis and through the other terrorist groups that we have armed. So we're calling for a weapons embargo and also a freeze on the funding from the countries that are actually supporting these terror groups, like the Saudis in particular, and we could talk about that later if you want. But that's widely acknowledged, including by Hillary Clinton in one of her Secretary of State emails that was leaked by WikiLeaks. So we can stop the funding of terrorism, we can stop the arming of terrorism, and we can stop draining our public resources. 54% of our discretionary budget is being spent on these wars for oil, which are just getting us into deeper and deeper trouble. So this is fixable. We can create the Green New Deal and fix the economy, fix our ecology, and create a world of peace and justice. This is the world that we can create, the world that's in our hands, and ending student debt, in my view, is the key, because that's how we can begin to push forward and create this world that works for all of us. Thank you so much.